were in Paris at the time of the revolution, and shortly thereafter you made your way home.
Exactly.
Now, I think I understand why you hurried back, to help your grandmother safely from the country. But having arranged for her escape, why did you choose to stay?
For the cuisine.
No, I am serious. My days of leaving Russia were behind me.
But you didn't take up arms with the whites?
No.
And you don't strike me as a coward?
I should hope not.
So why didn't you join in the fray?
The Count paused, then shrugged. When I left for Paris in 1914, I swore I would never shoot another one of my countrymen.
And you count the Bolsheviks as your countrymen?
Of course I do.
Do you count them as gentlemen?
That's another thing entirely, but certainly some of them are.
I see. But even from the manner in which you say that, I can tell that you do not count me a gentleman.
Now, why is that?
The Count responded with a light laugh, as much as to say that no gentleman would ever answer such a question.
Come now, the Colonel persisted. Here we two are dining together on the Boyarsky's roasted duck with a bottle of Georgian wine, which practically makes us old friends. And I am genuinely interested. What is it about me that makes you so sure that I am not a gentleman?
As a sign of encouragement, the Colonel leaned across the table to refill the Count's glass.
It isn't any one thing, the Count said after a moment. It is an assembly of small details.
Like in a mosaic?
Yes, like in a mosaic.
So, give me an example of one of these smaller details. The Count took a sip from his glass and replaced it on the table at 1 o'clock.
As a host, it was perfectly appropriate for you to take up the serving tools, but a gentleman would have served his guests before he served himself.
The Colonel, who had just taken a bite of duck, smiled at the Count's first example and waved his fork.
"Continue," he said. "A gentleman wouldn't gesture at another man with his fork," said the Count, "or speak with his mouth full. But perhaps, most importantly, he would have introduced himself at the beginning of a conversation, particularly when he had the advantage over his guest."
The Colonel put his utensils down. "And I ordered the wrong wine," he added with a smile. The Count put a finger in the air.
"No, there are many reasons for ordering a particular bottle of wine, and memories of home are among the best."
"Then allow me to introduce myself. I am Osip Ivanovich Glebnikov, former Colonel of the Red Army and an officer of the party, who, as a boy in eastern Georgia, dreamed of Moscow, and who, as a man of 39 in Moscow, dreams of eastern Georgia."
"It is a pleasure meeting you," said the Count, reaching across the table.
The two men shook hands and then resumed eating. After a moment, the Count ventured,
"If I may be so bold, Osip Ivanovich, what is it exactly that you do as an officer of the party?"
"Let's just say that I am charged with keeping track of certain men of interest."
"Ah, well, I imagine that becomes rather easy to achieve when you place them under house arrest."
"Actually," corrected Glebnikov, "it is easier to achieve when you place them in the ground." The Count conceded the point.
"But by all accounts," continued Glebnikov, "you seem to have reconciled yourself to your situation."
"As both a student of history and a man devoted to living in the present, I admit that I do not spend a lot of time imagining how things might otherwise have been, but I do like to think there is a difference between being resigned to a situation and reconciled to it." Glebnikov let out a laugh and gave the table a light slap.
"There you go. That's just the sort of nuance that has brought me begging to your door."
Setting his silverware down, the Count looked to his host with interest.
"As a nation, Alexander Ilyich, we are at a very interesting juncture.
We have had open diplomatic relations with the French and British for 7 years, and there is talk that we will soon have them with the Americans. Since the time of Peter the Great, we have acted the poor cousin of the West, admiring their ideas as much as we admired their clothes. But we are about to assume a very different role. Within a matter of years, we will be exporting more grain and manufacturing more steel than any other country in Europe. And we are leaps ahead of them all in ideology. As a result, for the first time, we are on the verge of taking our rightful place on the world stage. And when we do so, it will behoove us to listen with care and speak with clarity. You would like to learn French and English? Ossip raised his glass in confirmation. Yes, sir. But I don't simply want to learn the languages. I want to understand those who speak them. And most especially, I would like to understand their privileged classes. For that's who remains at the helm. I would like to understand how they view the world, what they are likely to count as a moral imperative, what they would be prone to value and what to disdain. It's a matter of developing certain diplomatic skills, if you will. But for a man in my position, it is best to foster one's skills discreetly. How do you propose that I help? Simple. Dine with me once a month in this very room. Speak with me in French and English. Share with me your impressions of Western societies. And in exchange... Glebnikov let his sentence trail off, not to imply the paucity of what he could do for the Count, but rather to suggest the abundance. But the Count raised a hand to stay any talk of exchanges. If you are a customer of the Boyarsky, Osip Ivanovich, then I am already at your service. Absinthe. As the Count approached the Shalyapin at 12:15, what emanated from this one-time chapel of prayer and reflection was a sound that would have been unthinkable 10 years before. It was a sound characterized by fits of laughter, a melange of languages, the bleat of a trumpet, and the clinking of glasses. In other words, the sound of gay abandon. What development could have brought about such a transformation? In the case of the Shalyapin, there were three. The first was the rather breathless return of the American musical form known as jazz. Having squelched the craze on the grounds of its intrinsic decadence, in the mid-1920s, the Bolsheviks had begun to countenance it again. This was presumably so that they could study more closely how a single idea can sweep the globe. Whatever the cause, here it was, zipping and zinging and rat-a-tat-tatting on its little stage at the back of the room. The second development was the return of foreign correspondents. In the aftermath of the revolution, the Bolsheviks had ushered them straight to the door, along with divinities, doubts, and all the other troublemakers. But correspondents are a wily bunch. Having stashed their typewriters, crossed the border, changed their clothes, and counted to 10, they began slipping back into the country, one by one. So in 1928... the Foreign Press Office was opened anew on the top floor of a 6-story walk-up conveniently located halfway between the Kremlin and the offices of the secret police, a spot that just happened to be across the street from the Metropole. Thus, on any given night, you could now find 15 members of the international press in the Shalyapin, ready to bend your ear. And when there were no listeners to be found, they lined up at the bar, like gulls on the rocks, and squawked all at once. And then there was the extraordinary development of 1929. In April of that year, the Shalyapin suddenly had not one, not two, but three hostesses, all young, beautiful, and wearing black dresses hemmed above the knee. With what charm and elegance they moved among the patrons of the bar, gracing the air with their slender silhouettes, delicate laughter, and hints of perfume. If the correspondents at the bar were inclined to talk more than they listened, in an instance of perfect symbiosis, the hostesses were inclined to listen more than they talked. In part, of course, this was because their jobs depended on it. For once a week, they were required to visit a little grey building on the corner of Dzerzhinsky Street, where some little grey fellow behind a little grey desk would record whatever they had happened to hear, word for word. Yes, this little grey fellow behind his little grey desk was charged not only with recording the information the waitresses gathered, but with ensuring their willing participation by reminding them of their duty to their country, by suggesting how easy it would be for them to lose their positions, and, when necessary, by making some other more ominous innuendo. But let us not condemn the fellow too quickly. For he has never been to the Shalyapin bar, nor has he dined at the Boyarsky. He has been allotted a vicarious life, a life in which all experiences are at arm's length, all sensations second hand. No bleat of the trumpet, no clink of the glass, no sight of a young woman's knee for him. Like a scientist's assistant, his lot was simply to record the data and then relay a summary to his superiors without embellishment or elaboration. To be fair, he was no slouch in this endeavour, and was even known throughout his department as something of a prodigy. For no one in all of Moscow could write a report to such drab perfection. With limited instruction, he had perfected the art of withholding his insights, foregoing his witticisms, curbing the use of metaphors, similes, and analogies. In essence, exercising every muscle of poetic restraint. In fact, if the reporters whom he was dutifully transcribing had only seen his handiwork, they would have taken off their hats, bowed their heads, and acknowledged that here was a master of objectivity. Did this obligation of the hostesses cause the journalist to be more cautious or tight-lipped for fear that some careless remark would be passed along? On the contrary, the Foreign Press Corps had a standing wager of $10 American to any of their number who could get summoned to the Commissariat of Internal Affairs. To that end, they crafted outrageous provocations and wove them into their chatter. One American let slip that in the backyard of a certain Dhaka, a disenchanted engineer was building a balloon from specifications he'd found in Jules Verne. Another relayed that an unnamed biologist was crossing a peep of chickens with a flock of pigeons to breed a bird that could lay an egg in the morning and deliver a message at night. In sum, they would say anything within earshot of the hostesses. That is, anything that might be underscored in a report and land with a thud on a desk in the Kremlin. As the Count stood at the Shalyapin's entrance, he could see that tonight there was even more cavorting than usual. The jazz ensemble in the corner, which was charged with setting the tempo, was scrambling to keep up with the eruptions of laughter and the slaps on the back. Working his way through the hubbub, the Count approached the more discreet end of the bar, where an alabaster pillar fell from the ceiling to the floor. A moment later, Odrius was leaning toward the Count with his forearm on the bar. "Good evening, Count Rostov."
"Good evening, Odrius. It seems like quite a celebration tonight."
The bartender gestured with his head toward one of the Americans.
"Mr. Lyons was taken to the office of the OGPU today."
"The OGPU? How so?"
"It seems that a letter written in his hand was found on the floor of Perloff's tea house. A letter that included descriptions of troop movements and artillery placements on the outskirts of Smolensk. But when his letter was laid on the desk and Mr. Lyons was asked to explain himself, he said that he'd simply been transcribing his favourite passage from War and Peace."
"Ah, yes," said the Count with a smile, "the Battle of Borodino."
"For this accomplishment, he collected the kitty and now he's buying everyone around." "But what can we do for you this evening?"
The Count tapped twice on the bar. You wouldn't happen to have any absinthe, would you?
Ever so slightly, Odrius raised an eyebrow. How well this tender of bar knew the Count's preferences. He knew that before dinner the Count enjoyed a glass of champagne or dry vermouth. He knew that after dinner he enjoyed a snifter of brandy until the average nightly temperature fell below 40 degrees, at which point he would switch to a glass of whisky or port. But absinthe? In the decade that they had known each other, the Count had not asked for a single glass. In fact, he rarely indulged in any of the syrupy liqueurs, and certainly not those that were coloured green and reported to cause madness. But ever the professional, Odrius confined his surprise to the movement of his eyebrow.
"I believe I may have one bottle left," he said. Then, opening a seamless door in the wall, he disappeared into the cabinet where he kept his more expensive and esoteric spirits. On the platform in the opposite corner of the bar, the jazz ensemble was playing a perky little tune. Admittedly, when the Count had first encountered jazz, he hadn't much of an affinity for it. He had been raised to appreciate music of sentiment and nuance, music that rewarded patience and attention with crescendos and diminuendos, allegros and adagios, artfully arranged over four whole movements. Not a fistful of notes crammed higgledy-piggledy into 30 measures. And yet, the art form had grown on him. Like the American correspondents, jazz seemed a naturally gregarious force, one that was a little unruly and prone to say the first thing that popped into its head, but generally of good humour and friendly intent. In addition, it seemed decidedly unconcerned with where it had been, or where it was going, exhibiting somehow simultaneously the confidence of the master and the inexperience of the apprentice. Was there any wonder that such an art had failed to originate in Europe? The Count's reverie was broken by the sound of a bottle being placed on the bar. "Absinthe Rebet," said Odrius, tilting the bottle so that the Count could read the label. "But I'm afraid there's only an ounce or two left."
"It will have to do." The bartender emptied the bottle into a cordial glass.
"Thank you, Odrius. Please add it to my account."
"No need. It is on Mr. Leon's."
As the Count turned to go, an American who had commandeered the piano began performing a jaunty little number that celebrated a lack of bananas. A lack of bananas today. A moment later, all the journalists were singing along. On another night, the Count might have lingered to observe the festivities, but he had his own celebration to attend to. So, with his precious cargo in hand, he navigated through the crowd of elbows, being careful not to spill a drop. "Yes," thought the Count, as he climbed the stairs to the second floor, "this evening the triumvirate has its own cause for celebration." The plan had been hatched almost 3 years before, springing from a wistful comment of André's, which had been echoed by Emile. "Sadly, it's impossible," the maitre d' had lamented. "Yes," the chef had conceded with a shake of the head. But was it? All told, there were 15 ingredients. 6 of them could be plucked from the pantry of the Boyarsky at any time of year. Another 5 were readily available in season. The nut of the problem was that, despite the overall improvement in the general availability of goods, the last 4 ingredients remained relatively rare. From the outset, it was agreed that there would be no skimping, no shortcuts or substitutions. It was the symphony or silence. So the triumvirate would have to be patient and watchful. They would have to be willing to beg, barter, collude, and, if necessary, resort to chicanery. 3 times the dream had been within their grasp, only to be snatched away at the last moment by unforeseen circumstances, once by mishap, once by mould, and once by mice. But earlier that week, it seemed that the stars were wheeling into alignment once again. With 9 elements already in Emile's kitchen, 4 whole haddock and a basket of mussels meant for the National Hotel had been delivered to the Metropole by mistake. That was 10 and 11 in a single stroke. The triumvirate convened and conferred. A favour could be called in by André, a swap negotiated by Emile, and Odrius approached by the Count. Thus, the 12th, 13th, and 14th ingredients. But the 15th? This would require access to a store with the rarest of luxuries. That is, one which served the highest members of the party. A discreet inquiry was made by the Count of a certain actress with certain connections. And mirabile dictu, an unsigned envelope had been slipped under his door. With all 15 ingredients now at hand, the triumvirate's patience was on the verge of being rewarded. Within the hour, they would once again experience that intricacy of flavours, that divine distillation, that impression as rich and elusive as, "Good evening, comrade." The Count stopped in his tracks. For a moment he hesitated. Then he slowly turned around, as from the shadows of an alcove, the hotel's assistant manager emerged. Like his counterpart on the chessboard, the Bishop of the Metropole never moved along the rank or file. With him it was always on the bias, slipping diagonally from corner to corner, skirting past a potted plant, sliding through a crack in the door. One caught sight of him at the periphery of one's vision, if one caught sight of him at all. "Good evening," replied the Count. The two men took each other in from heel to hair, both practiced at confirming in a glance their worst suspicions of each other. Leaning a little to his right, the bishop adopted an expression of idle curiosity. "What do we have here?"
"What do we have where?"
"Why, there, behind your back."
"Behind my back?"
The Count slowly brought his hands in front of him and turned his palms upright to show that they were empty. The right upper corner of the bishop's smile twitched, turning it ever so briefly into a smirk. The Count reciprocated in kind and, with a polite bow of the head, turned to walk away. "Headed to the Boyarsky?" The Count stopped and turned back.
"Yes, that's right. The Boyarsky."
"Isn't it closed?"
"It is, but I think I may have left my pen in Emile's office."
"Ah, the man of letters has lost his pen. Where is it now?"
"Hmm?
If not in the kitchen, perhaps you should look in the blue pagoda of your fine chinoiserie."
And turning with his smirk, the bishop slipped diagonally down the hall. The Count waited until he was out of sight, then hurried in the opposite direction, muttering as he went,
"Where is it now? Perhaps in your blue pagoda?"
Very witty, I'm sure, coming from a man who couldn't rhyme cow with plough. And what's with all that dot, dot, dotting? Ever since the bishop had been promoted, he had taken to adding an ellipsis at the end of every question. But what was one to infer from it? Dot, dot, dot. That this particular punctuation mark should be fended off. Dot, dot, dot. That an interrogative sentence should never end. Dot, dot, dot. That even though he is asking a question, he has no need of an answer because he has already formed an opinion. Dot, dot, dot. Of course. Coming through the Boyarsky's doors, which André had left unbolted, the Count crossed the empty dining room and passed through the swinging door into the kitchen. There he found the chef at his counter slicing a bulb of fennel, as 4 stalks of celery lying in an orderly row waited like Spartans to meet their fate.
to the side were the fillets of haddock and the basket of mussels, while on the stove sat a great copper pot, from which small clouds of steam graced the air with other intimations of the sea. Looking up from the fennel, Emile met the eye of the Count and smiled. In an instant, the Count could see that the chef was in rosy form. Having sensed, at two, that all might not be lost, at 12:30, the chef hadn't the slightest doubt that the sun would shine tomorrow, that most people were generous at heart, and that, when all was said and done, things tended to work out for the best. The chef wasted no time on salutations. Instead, without pausing his chopper, he tilted his head toward the little table, which had been moved from his office into the kitchen, and which had been waiting patiently to be set. But first things first. Carefully, the Count removed the little cordial glass from his back pocket and placed it on the counter.
"Ah," said the chef, wiping his hands on his apron.
"Is it enough?"
"It is only meant to be a hint, an aside, an innuendo. If it is the real thing, it should be plenty."
Emile dipped his pinky in the absinthe and gave it a lick.
"Perfect," he said.
Selecting an appropriate tablecloth from the linen closet, the Count unfurled it with a snap and let it billow to the table. As he set the places, the chef began to whistle a tune, and the Count smiled to realize it was the very same song that he had heard in the Shalyapin regarding the absence of bananas. As if on cue, the door to the back stair opened, and in rushed André with a pile of oranges about to tumble from his arms. Reaching Emile's side, he bowed at the waist and spilled them onto the counter. With the instincts of convicts who discover the gates of their prison open, the individual oranges rolled in every direction to maximize their chances of escape. In a flash, André had extended his arms in a grand circumference to fence them in. But one of the oranges dodged the maitre d's reach and shot across the counter, headed straight for the absinthe. Dropping his chopper, Emile lunged and plucked the glass from the counter in the nick of time. The orange, which was gaining in confidence, dashed behind the fennel, jumped from the counter, thudded to the floor, and made a break for the exit. But at the last moment, that door that separated Emile's kitchen from the rest of the world swung inward, sending the orange spinning back across the floor in the opposite direction, while in the doorway stood the bishop. The three members of the triumvirate froze. Advancing 2 paces north by northwest, the bishop took in the scene.
"Good evening, gentlemen," he said in his friendliest tone. "What brings you all to the kitchen at this hour?"
André, who'd had the presence of mind to step in front of the simmering pot, gestured with a hand toward the food on the counter.
"We are taking inventory."
"Inventory?"
"Yes, our quarterly inventory."
"Of course,"
the bishop replied with his ecclesiastical smile.
"And at whose request are you taking a quarterly inventory?"
As this exchange between the bishop and the maitre d' unfolded, the Count noticed that Emile, who had grown pale at the inward swinging of the door, was regaining his colour second by second. It had begun with a slight pinkness of the cheeks when the bishop had crossed the threshold. It turned to rose when the bishop asked, "What brings you all to the kitchen?" But when he asked, "At whose request?" the chef's cheeks, neck, and ears took on a purple of such moral indignation, it made one wonder if the presence of a question mark in his kitchen was itself a capital crime.
"At whose request?" the chef asked.
The bishop turned his gaze from André to Emile and was clearly struck by the chef's transformation. He seemed to waver.
"At whose request?" the chef repeated.
Without taking his eyes off the bishop, Emile suddenly reached for his chopper.
"At whose request?"
When Emile took a step forward while raising his chopping arm high above his head, The bishop grew as white as the haddock. Then the kitchen door was swinging on its hinge, and the bishop was nowhere to be seen. André and the Count turned their gaze from the door to Emile. Then, in wide-eyed amazement, André pointed a delicate finger at Emile's raised hand. For in the heat of outrage, the chef had grabbed not his chopper, but a celery stalk, whose little green fronds now trembled in the air. And to a man, the triumvirate burst into laughter. At one in the morning, the conspirators took their seats. On the table before them were a single candle, a loaf of bread, a bottle of rosé, and three bowls of bouillabaisse. After exchanging a glance, the three men dipped their spoons into the stew in unison. But for Emile, the gesture was a sleight of hand. For when André and the Count raised their spoons to their mouths, Emile let his hover above his bowl, intent upon studying his friend's expressions at the very first taste. Fully aware that he was being watched, the Count closed his eyes to attend more closely to his impressions. How to describe it? One first tastes the broth, that simmered distillation of fish bones, fennel, and tomatoes with their hearty suggestions of Provence. One then savours the tender flakes of haddock and the briny resilience of the mussels, which had been purchased on the docks from the fishermen. One marvels at the boldness of the oranges arriving from Spain, and the absinthe poured in the taverns. And all of these various impressions are somehow collected, composed, and brightened by the saffron, that essence of summer sun which, having been harvested in the hills of Greece and packed by mule to Athens, has been sailed across the Mediterranean in a felucca. In other words, with the very first spoonful one finds oneself transported to the port of Marseille, where the streets teem with sailors, thieves, and Madonnas, with sunlight and summer, with languages and life. The Count opened his eyes. Magnifique, he said. André, who had put down his spoon, brought his elegant hands together in a respectful show of silent applause. Beaming, the chef bowed to his friends and then joined them in their long-awaited meal. Over the next 2 hours, the three members of the triumvirate each ate three bowls of the bouillabaisse, each drank a bottle of wine, and each spoke openly in turn. And what did these old friends talk about? What did they not talk about? They talked of their childhoods in St. Petersburg, Minsk, and Lyon, of their first and second loves, of André's 4-year-old son and Emile's 4-year-old lumbago. They spoke of the once and the was, of the wishful and the wonderful. Rarely awake at this hour, Emile was in an unprecedented state of euphoria. As youthful stories were told, he laughed so heartily that his head rolled on his shoulders, and the corner of his napkin was raised to his eyes twice as often as it was raised to his lips. And the pièce de résistance? At 3 in the morning, André referred briefly, off-handedly, almost parenthetically, to his days under the big top.
Eh? What's that? Under what? Did you say the big top?
Yes, in point of fact, the circus. Raised by a widowed father who was prone to drunken violence, at the age of 16, André had run away to join a travelling circus. It was with this troupe that he had come to Moscow in 1913, where, having fallen in love with a bookseller in the Arbat, he had bid the circus adieu. 2 months later, he was hired as a waiter at the Boyarsky, and he had been there ever since.
"What did you do in the circus?" asked the Count.
"An acrobat?" suggested Emile. "A clown?"
"A lion tamer?"
"I juggled."
"No,"
said Emile. In lieu of a response, the maitre d' rose from the table and gathered three of the unused oranges from the countertop. With the fruit in his hands, he stood perfectly erect. Or rather, he stood at a slight tilt induced by the wine, a sort of 1202. Then, after a brief pause, he set the spheres in motion. In all honesty, the Count and Emile had been sceptical of their old friend's claim, but as soon as he began, they could only wonder that they had not guessed at it before. For André's hands had been crafted by God to juggle. So deft was his touch that the oranges seemed to move of their own accord. Or better yet, they moved like planets governed by a force of gravity that simultaneously propelled them forward and kept them from flinging off into space. While André, who was standing before these planets, seemed to be simply plucking them from their orbits and releasing them a moment later to pursue their natural course. So gentle and rhythmic was the motion of André's hands that one was at constant risk of falling under hypnosis. And, in fact, without Emile or the Count noticing, another orange had suddenly joined the solar system. And then, with a courtly flourish, André caught all four spheres and bowed at the waist. Now it was the Count and Emile's turn to applaud.
"But surely you didn't juggle oranges," said Emile.
"No," André admitted, as he carefully returned the oranges to the counter. "I juggled knives."
Before the Count and Emile could express their disbelief, André had taken three blades from a drawer and set them in motion. These were no planets. They spun through the air like the parts of some infernal machine, an effect that was heightened by the flashes of light from whenever the candle's flame was reflected on the surface of the blades. And then, just as suddenly as the knives had been set in motion, their hilts were fixed in André's hands.
"Ah, but can you do four of those?" teased the Count.
Without a word, André moved back toward the knife drawer. But before he could reach inside, Emile had risen to his feet. With the expression of a boy enthralled by a street magician, he shyly stepped from the crowd and held out his chopper. That blade, which had not been touched by another human hand in almost 15 years. With an appropriate sense of ceremony, André bowed from the waist to accept it. And when he set the four knives in motion, Emile leaned back in his chair and, with a tear in his eye, watched as his trusted blade tumbled effortlessly through space, feeling that this moment, this hour, this universe could not be improved upon. At 3:30 in the morning, the Count swayed up the stairs, veered to his room, lurched through his closet, emptied his pockets onto the bookcase, poured himself a brandy, and with a sigh of satisfaction, dropped into his chair. While from her place on the wall, Helena took him in with a tender, knowing smile.
"Yes, yes," he admitted. "It is a little late, and I am a little drunk, but, in my defence, it has been an eventful day."
As if to make his point, the Count suddenly rose from his chair and tugged at one of the folds of his jacket.
"Do you see this button? I'll have you know that I sewed it on myself."
Then, dropping back in his chair, the Count picked up his brandy, took a sip, and reflected.
"She was perfectly right, you know. Marina, I mean. Absolutely, positively, perfectly right."
The Count sighed again. Then he shared with his sister a notion. "Since the beginning of storytelling," he explained, "death has called on the unwitting. In one tale or another, it arrives quietly in town and takes a room at an inn, or lurks in an alleyway, or lingers in the marketplace, surreptitiously. Then, just when the hero has a moment of respite from his daily affairs, death pays him a visit."
"This is all well and good," allowed the Count, "but what is rarely related is the fact that life is every bit as devious as death. It, too, can wear a hooded coat, It too can slip into town, lurk in an alley, or wait in the back of a tavern. Hadn't it paid such a visit to Mishka? Hadn't it found him hiding behind his books, lured him out of the library, and taken his hand on a secluded spot overlooking the Neva? Hadn't it found Andre in Leon and beckoned him to the big top? Emptying his glass, the Count rose from his chair and stumbled into the bookcase as he reached for the brandy.
"Excusez-moi, monsieur."
The Count poured himself a tad, just a drop, no more than a sip, and fell back into his seat. Then, waving a finger gently in the air, he continued.
"The collectivization of collectives, Helena, and the de-kulaking of kulaks. In all probability, these are quite probable. They're even likely to be likely. But inevitable?"
With a knowing smile, the Count shook his head at the very sound of the word.
"Allow me to tell you what is inevitable. What is inevitable is that life will pay Nina a visit too. She may be as sober as St. Augustine, but she is too alert and too vibrant for life to let her shake a hand and walk off alone. Life will follow her in a taxi. It will bump into her by chance. It will work its way into her affections. And to do so, it will beg, barter, collude, and, if necessary, resort to chicanery." "What a world!"
The Count sighed at last, before falling asleep in his chair. On the following morning, with his eyes a little blurry and his head a little sore, the Count poured a second cup of coffee, settled himself in his chair, and leaned to his side in order to retrieve Mishka's letter from his jacket. But it wasn't there. The Count distinctly remembered tucking the letter in the inside pocket when he was leaving the lobby the day before, and it had definitely been there when he had repaired the button in Marina's office. It must have fallen out, he thought, when he draped the jacket over the back of Anna's chair. So, after finishing his coffee, the Count went down to Suite 311, only to find the door open, the closets empty, and the bottom of the dustbins bare. But Mishka's half-read letter had not fallen from the Count's jacket in Anna's room. Having emptied his pockets at 3:30, when the Count had stumbled reaching for the brandy, he had knocked the letter into the gap between the bookcase and the wall, where it was destined to remain. Though perhaps this was just as well. For while the Count had been so moved by Mishka's bittersweet walk along Nevsky Prospect and his romantic lines of verse, the lines of verse were not written by Mishka at all. They were from the poem that Mayakovsky had delivered while standing on his chair back in 1923. And what had prompted Mishka to quote them had nothing to do with the day that Katerina had first taken his hand. What had prompted the citation, and the writing of the letter, for that matter, was the fact that on the 14th of April, Vladimir Mayakovsky, the poet laureate of the Revolution, had shot himself through the heart with a prop revolver. Addendum. On the morning of the 22nd of June, even as the Count was looking through his pockets for Mishka's letter, Nina Kulikova and her three confederates were boarding a train headed east for Ivanovo, full of energy, excitement, and a clear sense of purpose. Since the launch of the first five-year plan in 1928, tens of thousands of their comrades in the urban centres had been working tirelessly to build power stations, steel mills, and manufacturing plants for heavy machinery. As this historic effort unfolded, it would be essential for the country's grain-producing regions to do their part, by meeting the increased demand for bread in the cities with leaps in agricultural production. But to pave the way for this ambitious effort, it was deemed necessary to exile 1 million kulaks, those profiteers and enemies of the common good, who also happened to be the region's most capable farmers. The remaining peasants, who viewed newly introduced approaches to agriculture with resentment and suspicion, proved antagonistic to even the smallest efforts at innovation. Tractors, which were meant to usher in the new era by the fleet, ended up being in short supply. These challenges were compounded by uncooperative weather, resulting in a collapse of agricultural output. But given the imperative of feeding the cities, the precipitous decline in the harvest was met with increased quotas and requisitions, enforced at gunpoint. In 1932, the combination of these intractable forces would result in widespread hardship for the agricultural provinces of old Russia, and death by starvation for millions of peasants in Ukraine. While many of the young loyalists, like Nina, who joined the Udarniks in the countryside, would have their faith in the party tested by what they witnessed, most of Russia, and for that matter the world, would be spared the spectacle of this man-made disaster. For just as peasants from the countryside were forbidden to enter the cities, journalists from the cities were forbidden to enter the countryside. Delivery of personal mail was suspended, and the windows of passenger trains were blackened. In fact, so successful was the campaign to contain awareness of the crisis, when word leaked out that millions were starving in Ukraine, Walter Duranty, the lead correspondent for the New York Times in Russia, and one of the ringleaders in the Shalyapin bar, would report that these rumours of famine were grossly exaggerated and had probably originated with anti-Soviet propagandists. Thus, the world would shrug. And even as the crime unfolded, Duranty would win the Pulitzer Prize. But, as noted, all of this was still in the offing. And when Nina's train finally arrived in the far reaches of Ivanovo, where the fields of young wheat bent in the breeze for as far as the eye could see, she was almost overwhelmed by the beauty of the landscape, and by the sense that her life had just begun. 1938, an arrival. Let us concede that the early 30s in Russia were unkind. In addition to starvation in the countryside, the famine of 32 eventually led to a migration of peasants to the cities, which, in turn, contributed to overcrowded housing, shortages of essential goods, even hooliganism. At the same time, the most stalwart workers in the urban centres were wearying under the burden of the continuous workweek. Artists faced tighter constraints on what they could or could not imagine. Churches were shuttered, repurposed, or razed. And when revolutionary hero Sergei Kirov was assassinated, the nation was purged of an array of politically unreliable elements. But then, on the 17th of November 1935, at the first all-union conference of Stakhanovites, Stalin himself declared, "Life has improved, comrades. Life is more joyous." Yes, generally speaking, such a remark falling from the lips of a statesman should be swept from the floor with the dust and the lint. But when it fell from the lips of Sosa, one had good reason to lend it credence. For it was often through secondary remarks in secondary speeches that the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party signalled the shifts in his thinking. In point of fact, a few days before giving this speech, Sosa had seen a photograph in the Herald Tribune of three healthy young Bolshevik girls standing before a factory gate, dressed in the tunic and kerchief long favoured by the party. Normally, such a picture would have warmed the cockles of his heart, but in the context of the Western press, it struck the Secretary of Secretaries that this simple attire might suggest to the world that after 18 years of communism, Russian girls still lived like peasants. Thus, the fateful sentences were slipped into the speech, and the direction of the country veered. For upon reading in Pravda that life had improved, the attentive apparatchiks understood that a turning point had been reached, that given the revolution's unqualified success, the time had come for the party not only to countenance but to encourage a little more glamour, a little more luxury, a little more laughter. Within a matter of weeks, the Christmas tree and gypsy music, both long in exile, were given a warm welcome home. Polina Molotova, wife of the foreign minister, was entrusted with the launch of the first Soviet perfumes. The new light factory, with the help of some imported machinery, was charged with producing champagne at the rate of 10,000 bottles a day. Members of the Politburo traded in their military uniforms for tailored suits, and those hard-working girls exiting their factories were now encouraged to look not like peasants, but like the girls along the Champs-Élysées. True, there was still one more purge to see to, but this one was to be directed at high party officials and members of the secret police. In fact, Genrik Yagoda, the dreaded head of the NKVD, was about to get his. Accused of treason, conspiracy, and diamond smuggling, Yagoda would be tried publicly in the Palace of Unions, right across the square from the Metropole Hotel, found guilty and summarily shot. So, this too would be regarded by many as a harbinger of brighter days. So, not unlike that fellow in Genesis who said, "Let there be this," or "Let there be that," and there was this or that, when Sosso said, "Life has improved, comrades." Life, in fact, improved. Case in point, at this very moment, two young ladies are strolling down Kuznetsky Most, wearing brightly coloured dresses fitted at the waist and hemmed at the calf. One of them even sports a yellow hat with a brim that slopes seductively over a long-lashed eye. With the rumble of the brand-new metro underfoot, they pause before three of the great windows at SUM, the Central Universal Department Store, which respectively showcase a pyramid of hats, a pyramid of watches, and a pyramid of high-heeled shoes. Granted, the girls still live in crowded apartments and wash their pretty dresses in a common sink, but do they look through the store's windows with resentment? Not in the least. With envy, perhaps, or wide-eyed wonder, but not resentment. For the doors of the SUM are no longer closed to them. Having long served foreigners and high party officials, the store had been open to the citizenry in 36, as long as they could pay the cashier in foreign currencies, silver or gold. In fact, on SUM's lower level, there is a nicely appointed office where a discreet gentleman will give you store credit for half the value of your grandmother's jewellery. You see, life is more joyous. So, having admired the contents of the windows and imagined the day when they too might have an apartment with closets in which to stow their hats, watches and shoes, our fetching pair resumes their stroll, all the while chatting about the two well-connected young men they are on their way to meet for dinner. At Teatralny Proyetst, they wait at the curb for a break in the flow of automobiles. Then, skipping across the street, they enter the Metropole Hotel where, as they pass the concierge's desk en route to the piazza, they are admired by a distinguished-looking man with a touch of grey in his hair. "Ah, the end of spring," observed the Count to Vasily, who was sorting through the night's reservations. "By the hems of the skirts on those young ladies, I'd wager it must be almost 70 degrees along Vyskaya, despite being 7 o'clock at night. In another few days, the boys will be stealing posies from the Alexander Gardens, and Emil will be scattering peas across his plates." "No doubt," said the concierge, in the manner of a librarian agreeing with a scholar. Earlier that day, in fact, the first strawberries of the season had arrived in the kitchen, and Emil had slipped a handful to the Count for his breakfast the following morning. "Without question," concluded the Count, "summer is now at the gates, and the days that ensue are sure to be long and carefree. Alexander Ilyich." At the unexpected sound of his own name, the Count turned to find another young lady standing right behind him, though this one was in a pair of pants. 5.5 feet tall, she had straight blonde hair, light blue eyes, and a rare sense of self-possession.
"Nina!" he exclaimed.
What a sight for sore eyes. We haven't heard from you in ages. When did you get back to Moscow?
May I speak with you a moment?
Certainly.
Sensing that something personal must have prompted the visit, the Count followed Nina a few paces from the concierge's desk.
It is my husband, she began.
Your husband? The Count interjected. You've gotten married.
Yes, she said. Leo and I have been married for 6 years. We worked together in Ivanovo.
Why, I remember him.
Frustrated by the Count's interruptions, Nina shook her head.
You would not have met him.
You're quite right. We did not meet, per se,
but he was here with you in the hotel just before you left.
The Count couldn't help but smile to recall the handsome Komsomol captain who had sent the others on ahead so that he could wait for Nina alone. Nina tried for a moment to recollect this visit with her husband to the Metropole, but then waved a hand as if to say whether or not they had been in the hotel all those years ago was of no consequence.
Please, Alexander Ilyich, I don't have much time. 2 weeks ago, we were recalled from Ivanovo to attend a conference on the future of agricultural planning. On the first day of the meetings, Leo was arrested. After some effort, I tracked him to the Lubyanka, but they wouldn't let me see him. Naturally, I began to fear the worst. But yesterday, I received word that he has been sentenced to 5 years corrective labour. They're putting him on a train tonight for Sevoslag. I'm going to follow him there. What I need is for someone to watch over Sophia while I get myself settled.
Sophia?
The Count followed Nina's glance across the lobby to where a girl of 5 or 6 with black hair and ivory skin was in a high-backed chair, her feet dangling a few inches from the floor. I can't take her with me now, as I will need to find work and a place to live. It may take a month or two, but once I have established myself, I'll come back for her. Nina had explained these developments as one reports a series of scientific outcomes, a succession of facts that warranted our fear and indignation as much as would the laws of gravity or motion. But the Count could no longer contain some sense of shock, if only due to the speed at which the particulars were unfolding. A husband, a daughter, an arrest, the Lubyanka, corrective labour. Interpreting the Count's expression as one of hesitation, Nina, that most self-reliant of souls, gripped the Count by the arm.
I have no one else to turn to, Alexander.
Then, after a pause, she added,
Please?
Together, the Count and Nina crossed the lobby to this child of 5 or 6 with black hair, white skin, and dark blue eyes. Had the Count been introduced to Sophia under different circumstances, he might have observed with quiet amusement the signs of Nina's rugged practicality on display. That Sophia wore simple clothes, that her hair was almost as short as a boy's, and that the linen doll she hugged by the neck didn't even have a dress. Nina knelt so that she could see her daughter eye to eye. She put a hand on Sophia's knee and began to speak in a tenor the Count had never heard her speak in before. It was the tenor of tenderness.
Sonia, this is your Uncle Sasha, whom I have told you so much about. The one who gave you the pretty binoculars?
Yes, said Nina with a smile.
The very same.
Hello, Sophia, said the Count.
Nina then explained that while Mama went to prepare their new home, Sophia would be staying for a few weeks in this lovely hotel. Nina told her that until Mama returned, she must be strong and respectful and listen to her uncle.
And then we will take the long train to Papa, the girl said.
That's right, my sweet. Then we will take the long train to Papa.
Sophia was doing her best to match her mother's fortitude, but she did not yet have her mother's command over her own emotions. So while she did not question, or plead, or act dismayed, when she nodded to show that she understood, tears fell down her cheeks. Nina used her thumb to wipe the tears away from one side of her daughter's face, as Sophia used the back of her hand to wipe them away from the other. Nina looked Sophia in the eye
until she was sure the tears had stopped. Then, nodding once, she gave her daughter a kiss on the forehead and led the Count a few yards away. "Here," she said, handing him a canvas pack with shoulder straps,